from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison.
Members, this budget is not our preference.
Share the pain.
We got to stop the game.
No baloney.
Taxes, taxes, taxes.
The next step's the governor's.
Only the good Lord knows.
Mr. Secretary, call the roll.
Governor Brown's attempts to fix California's budget problems have led him to inevitably to address California's overburdened and overcommitted public pension funds. And that subject leads us to John Ortiz, who writes about the state and state workers for the Sacramento Bee. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks.
Let's listen to a little bit of what Governor Brown said the other day.
Applying this is going to take some care, but I've laid out what I think is a minimum that every plan in California ought to meet. And the minimum protects the taxpayer while being fair to the employees. So this is what it is, and I intend to work carefully with both parties, and maybe this might be a time when Republicans and Democrats actually might work together.
John Ortiz, what exactly is Governor Brown proposing?
He wants to, he has a 12-point plan that would reduce the benefits for future public employees, state and local, and would also have some impact on current employees.
And what are some of the details of the plan? What are some of the maybe we don't want to go all through all 12 points,
right?
But what are the key ones?
We'll hit two or three of the high points. One is he wants to move new workers into what's called a hybrid pension plan. Currently, workers have guaranteed pensions, and they're backed by the state or local government that employs them. The hybrid plan would reduce the guaranteed pension and introduce a 401k-style defined contribution that would have, you know, shift more of the risk to the workers. Social Security would be a third component.
And this is something that the private sector has had for a long time, right? This combination, or maybe not even a combination, maybe just a 401k.
Yeah, the 401k is the more prevalent now. The federal government has a hybrid plan that's like this.
And what has been the response to that portion of this? Because that's sort of that's one of the main points of this.
It is. Well, labor, I think, is distressed about this. They expected a hybrid proposal, but they didn't think the governor would make it mandatory. And I think they're weighing, they came out yesterday, you know, with some concerns. Had this been Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Brown's Republican predecessor, we would have gone into holy war yesterday. But the unions really kind of took a more measured response, and I think they're weighing what they're going to do because Jerry Brown is their guy. They helped him get elected.
Right, and this is kind of an unprecedented scenario in some ways, isn't it, in terms of both the budget and in terms of the we have both houses of the or all three houses of the government run by the Democrats, and yet there's going to we're looking at quite a conflict over this, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I think yesterday you saw some of the Democratic leadership in the legislature come out and said, you know, well, this is a good start. And Daryl Steinberg said, we're going to pass a robust pension reform package. But you certainly didn't see anybody standing up with the governor yesterday when he rolled this out at his press conference.
Yeah, I noted that Daryl Steinberg wasn't there and John Perez wasn't there.
Right. And so, I do think that the governor will have some dissent in his own party over this.
Speaking with John Ortiz of the Sacramento Bee about Governor Brown's pension reform proposals, as part of this is that they're going to go back to, they're going to grandfather everybody in, basically, who's already a state employee, correct? I mean, it's current versus future employees?
Well, some of the provisions would apply only to people who have not yet been hired by the state. Some provisions would apply to future and current workers, for example. The governor wants to split the contribution that employers and employees make 50-50. Currently, employers usually pay the majority of that. They'll pay maybe two-thirds of the contribution each month. And some local governments, the employees pay nothing. And so it puts a pretty big burden on the government relative to what the employees pay in.
And were public safety people excluded from this?
No. And that's another thing that some people were surprised by. The governor wants to reduce their pensions as well. In their case, most of them don't participate in Social Security, so they would have a smaller defined benefit, a smaller guaranteed pension, and then they'd also have this 401-style defined contribution.
Now, we discussed Labor's response. We discussed the Democrats' response. How do the Republicans feel about this? Because this is something that they've wanted for a long time.
Well, the Republicans, as you looked at what they were saying yesterday, it was kind of from not good enough, Jerry, to I could get behind this as a first step. I don't think anybody on the Republican side said, oh, this solves the problem. But, you know, they were willing to take a half a loaf.
Mm-hmm. And what about things like another of the 12 points was the retirement age, right?
Yes.
That's got to be a big one.
That's huge. Currently, and it's very difficult when you talk about these things because contracts and the government agency, these things are all so varied in their terms. But generally speaking, public safety employees, highway patrol, police, fire, they can retire at 50 or 55. And most other state workers would get full benefits at age 60 or 62. Brown's plan adds 5 years to that 62 number, brings their full retirement age up to 67, which is aligned with Social Security.
Right.
And then he was kind of squishy about what would happen to cops and fire and those folks. He clearly, though, wants to raise the retirement age for those people, too.
Any other key points in the 12 points that we should know about?
No, that's pretty much it. Those are the big ones.
Okay, and so the process is he announced that he's going to propose this legislation, but he's not the legislature is not in session right now. So when will this actually?
I would imagine that you'll see something come out early next year, maybe toward the end of this year. He might have some sort of a draft ready, but you know, this will go full speed ahead when the legislature comes back in.
And full speed being when do you, because there's a time factor in this as well, right?
Right. I think, well, there's some special hearings going on right now. You know, it's possible that they'll consider this. In fact, it's likely they'll consider Brown's plans during these two sessions that are coming up between now and the end of the year. And then, you know, you'll see the legislation start debate in January.
This gives people, particularly organized labor, a good bit of running room between now and January, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And you better believe that they are talking with the Democrats about this. One of the labor leaders that I talked to yesterday said, we're about to find out who our friends are.
Speaking with John Ortiz from the Sacramento Bee, the other thing is that if this does not go through the legislature, then Brown has said that he's going to go to an initiative for next November's ballot. Is that correct?
Well, what would have to happen is this could get to the ballot one of two ways, and it's clear that the second way is not going to happen. The legislature can approve it with a two-thirds vote, put it on the November 2012 ballot. Or you could try to go to the people, gather signatures, and put something on that way. But that costs, you know, upwards of $2 million just to collect the signatures, and then there would be a, you know, the commensurate ad war that goes with that. It's hard to imagine that the governor would be able to go the signature route. So he's going to have to depend on the legislature to make this happen.
Where is there any sense of where the public stands on this? Because that's...
Yeah, sure. When you look at polling on public pensions, across party lines, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, there is a strong feeling that public employee pensions need to be reduced.
Mm-hmm. And you don't see anything of that changing? And is that going to be something that would be something that Jerry Brown can hold over the legislature?
Well, he could try to use the bully pulpit, I think. But, you know, truth to be told, the pension issue just doesn't wind the watch for a lot of interest groups. It's complex. It's a down the road problem. And so while there's a lot of lip service paid to reform, there's been very little that's actually been done.
Speaking of state workers, there are some state workers that look like they may be losing their jobs or maybe some layoffs. What's that about?
Yeah, the Department of Corrections issued 26,000 layoff warning notices, essentially what they told these people, and they all had less than 10 years of service. They said, look, we're downsizing. Brown's realignment plan is dictating that they're going to shrink the prison population through attrition, basically. And So you're in danger of losing your job. Now, ultimately, my guess is the actual job loss will be on the order of a few thousand jobs, maybe. Mm-hmm. But they basically are telling people, look around, see where else you can go where your job might not be axed, because we're serious, we're downsizing.
Because layoff notices are sort of standard operating procedure in recent years, right? Teachers got, a lot of teachers got them last year and then ended up getting their jobs back.
Right.
Is there a sense this year that the that those layoff notices might mean an actual layoff? Or is it still kind of like a numbers game and you may not be among the few percent that
Well, it is a numbers game. I mean, clearly they're not going to lay off 20,000 people in a 60,000 employee department. But, you know, you're running a risk. Do you feel lucky?
Mm-hmm. And also, tens of thousands of state workers are coming back to work or coming back to full-time work. What's that shift?
Yeah. between furloughs that were imposed by Arnold Schwarzenegger and the legislature in 2009, and then subsequently contracts that were negotiated with Schwarzenegger, many employees have not had full hours in pay for a long time, since early 2009. The contracts now are the provision in the contracts that were giving employees, 95,000 of them in the case of SEIU Local 1000. Those contracts now, the provision is coming to an end beginning November. They go back to full hours in pay.
And which reminds me of some of, I know people who work at the state and have been there for the last 10 years and haven't gotten a raise at all and been hit real hard by these furloughs.
Right.
There are different unions that are representing different groups of state workers, right?
Absolutely. There are a dozen unions representing just the folks who are under the governor's authority. 230,000 employees, everything from custodians to cops. Mm-hmm. And they all have different deals. They all make different amounts of money. Many of them haven't seen a significant raise in a long, long time. In the case of SEIU, these 95,000 employees I was talking about, their wages haven't even kept up with the consumer price index over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of them haven't received anything for a long time.
And in Brown's proposal, because Sacramento is disproportionately impacted by anything that happens with the state, is there a local interest or are there local politicians who are particularly interested in what happens in terms of the pension reform? Because there are a lot of state pensioners living in Sacramento.
Right. Yeah. Daryl Steinberg, has been a kind of a leading voice with this, the Sacramento Senate pro tem president. But, you know, he's walking a fine line because he knows his constituency. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he needs to be a responsible leader who is, you know, doing the right things for the state's finances.
And speaking of leading voices, we lost one recently.
Yes, we did.
And that's tell us about Tim Hodson.
He was the director here of the Center for Government Studies at Sac State. Longtime legislative staffer, he just knew state government. When I started this beat covering state workers, it had never been done before. Never been done anywhere in the country. So when I started reaching out to colleagues asking them, well, who should I talk to about this? Because I don't have any idea what I'm doing. Tim's name came up time and time again. So we got together, we had lunch. And he gave me a piece of advice that I've never forgotten. He said, look, people write about state workers all the time. Nobody writes for them. If you write for them, you'll be a huge success. And I've never forgotten that.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with the Bee's John Ortiz about the state and state workers. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, California's dwindling expenditures on education. You're listening to Inside on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Check us out on Facebook and become one of our fans. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. And speaking of Insight Online, our assistant producer James Morrison has some more on that. Hey, James.
Well, happy Halloween, David.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Well, I know it's a little early, but I just wanted to say that now, because we're not going to have a show on Halloween or the next day. That's Monday and Tuesday next week. But we will have a nice treat instead. Tina Fey from 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live will be hosting a program produced by the award-winning Kitchen Sisters. It's called The Hidden World of Girls, and it will be full of powerful and funny coming-of-age stories from girls around the world. When we return on Wednesday, we'll talk about the economic effects the NBA lockout is having in Sacramento. That's the day when the Kings' first regular season game was scheduled. At this point, we don't know when or even if there will be a first home game this season, although reports today suggest the dispute between the league and the players might be resolved soon. Well, what do you think about the NBA lockout? Has it soured you on the game, or will you jump right back in once the season starts? Perhaps you like the fact the long NBA season will likely be shorter. Let us know how you feel on our Facebook page, Insight, on Capital Public Radio, or send an email to insight@capradio.org.
California's budget woes, thanks, James. California's budget woes are nothing new, and perhaps the department to suffer the longest because of the dwindling resources is the Department of Education. Now, automatic spending cuts are threatening to cut education even further. And joining me to discuss this is Gene Ross, who is the executive director of the California Budget Project. Gene, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, David.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Your group recently released a report that showed that California's spending on education is among the lowest in the United States. What exactly did your report find?
What we found is that California's spending for each of the students in our public schools ranks 46th among the 50 states. I think what's perhaps more troubling, not only that we're near the bottom, is the fact that the gap between what we spend on each student and that for the rest of the country is at its largest point at any time in the past four decades. So we are falling further behind, and unless we begin to get the resources that we need to balance our budget, to make the investments going forward that will ensure a quality education, the future doesn't look much brighter.
And I would think some people would respond and say, well, this is just about money. How does money equal quality in education? What do you measure to determine that?
We certainly look at the money, and money isn't everything, but it's a lot. And I think, you know, maybe if you're close to what the country spends as a whole, a few dollars on the margin don't make a big difference. But when you're so far behind as California is, certainly money is a big part of the problem. We have the largest class sizes, and by that I mean we have the most students for every teacher in our public school system. We rank 49th in terms of the number of students for guidance counselors, and that's so important when you're talking about students getting the advice that they need to have the coursework that prepares them to go on to college or prepares them for job training, so important in this economy. We're 50th in terms of the number of students for each librarian. We're 46th in terms of the number of students for each administrator. So it's not a problem of being top-heavy in our school system. We are so far behind in terms of all of the adults that are there to provide leadership to the young people in our school system.
I'm speaking with Gene Ross of the California Budget Project about the state of education. This is something that has been going on for quite a while. I've heard references to we're just above Mississippi in the listings. Is this a steady decline, or is this something that has accelerated in recent years because of our budget problems?
It's accelerated. We actually began to narrow that gap at the beginning of the last decade, 2000-2001, when state revenues rose with the dot-com boom. But since we turned that corner and first went into the downturn of the early part of the last decade, more recently into the Great Recession and that horrendous impact it's had on our state budget, we've seen the gap widen quite strikingly.
I'm assuming that since we're below the average of 11,764 per student, there must be some states that are well above that.
And many of them are the states that do well in all of the performance test states, like New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, traditionally have done well. Those are the states. When we talk about competition among the states, a lot of the states that make a very strong commitment to their public schools are the ones that do spend significantly more than California.
And that was sort of precludes my next question, but I was thinking, well, maybe it's because of the size of California, and we're a big state, and we're a diverse state, and it's very complicated to educate a large number of people, but you're saying New York is one of the top states.
And again, all of these numbers are indexed for the size of our school system. We're talking about per student. So,
right.
Yes, there are large states that make significant investments, some smaller states as well. But I think, again, it's always important to talk about what we're providing for each of the students. And if anything, to know that the gaps we're talking about are probably understated. And that's because California has a large, proportionately large number of students from poor families. We have a large number of students for whom English isn't a first language. And all of the educational research tells us that those students actually cost more to educate. And so we, in order to provide parity, we'd actually need to have a spending level above that for the nation as a whole, not below.
And now we're looking at new budget cuts coming up. It sounds like these are automatic budget cuts?
There are some triggers, so-called triggers, that were included in the budget agreement signed into law by the governor in June. And those triggers say that if revenue forecasts, the governor's revenue forecast, the legislative analyst, the nonpartisan body that advises the legislature, if those forecasts don't show state revenues likely to hit particular targets, there are some automatic reductions that would take place. There is a period for the legislature to review those cuts. I think it's still too soon to tell whether the triggers will be pulled, as people say around the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some good economic performance, some encouraging data come out this week. It's still very early. There's some quirks with regards to when some tax payments come in, so we don't have really good data to predict going forward yet. So I think it'll be close. I think it's still a little too soon to know whether or not we're likely to see those reductions occur.
John Ortiz and I discussed Governor Brown's proposal regarding pension reform. Pensions are a big cost in the education budget, aren't they?
They are a portion of the cost. They're not a large part of the cost, but they're not a large part of the state budget. And I think because of a lot of the dialogue around pensions, the debates right now that's become very emotional and very charged, there may be a perception that pensions are a larger part. In terms of the state budget for state employees, we're talking at about 3% of total state spending. The contributions to CalSTRS, which funds the teachers' retirement system, less than 1% of what the state spends.
Oh, okay. Well, this debate's going to go on for a while. When John Ortiz was just on, we also discussed the late Tim Hodson, and you worked closely with him, didn't you?
Fortunate to work with Tim over the years. We frequently ended up on panels at conferences or in public hearings. A tremendous loss to the state. Just a voice of reason, someone who, in these times when we hear about how voters don't always trust their government, don't trust public service, Tim dedicated his life to encouraging young people to pursue public service as a career, regardless of their political affiliation. Such a wonderful human being.
Well, it sounds like he'll be missed.
He will be missed.
All right. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Jean Ross of the California Budget Project. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
All right. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, singer and guitarist Skip Heller. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. For more about the people and topics on our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray, who joins us from the newsroom. Well, Alan, what's up?
Yeah, good day, sir. Well, among the big things happening today is a public event sponsored by the group Think Big Sacramento. They're the people behind the plan for a new sports and entertainment complex, which would be effectively a playpen for the Sacramento Kings down the rail yards. California Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, who, of course, is from Sacramento, will be giving a presentation outlining AB 900. That's a bill that was signed into law that is designed to promote large job-creating development projects throughout the state. And one of those would be, guess what? That would be the one down in the rail yards. Now, anybody who remembers Ronald Reagan and the years of the Republican 11th Commandment would remember that it's not nice for Republicans to say anything bad about other Republicans, and they tried for a long time not to, we thought. Well, now comes the leader of the Tea Party in America, writing in a website called The American Minority, saying that it's time for Michelle Bachmann to drop out of the race for the White House, even if she is the leader of the House Tea Party caucus. It is time, according to this note from Ned Ryan, who is the president of American Majority, it's time for Michelle Bachmann to go. For the last 2 years, he says, I've been cautioning about the dangers of individuals or organizations trying to present themselves as leaders of the Tea Party movement. This could get ugly. Those stories and more on All Things Considered beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
If the name Skip Heller is unfamiliar to you, you're in for a treat. This guy has been playing out and about for quite a while now, whether as a singer doing roots music or a guitarist playing jazz, but he hasn't gotten around these parts very often. But he's playing here tomorrow night at Shine downtown, and he's in our studio right now. Skip Heller, welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you. It's actually, I've never been to Sacramento before.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
I only got to see it in the dark last night on the way from the airport, but it looks spectacular.
And are you based in L.A.?
I'm based in L.A., yeah. I grew up in Philadelphia, but I'm based in Los Angeles.
Okay. And you've been touring for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. I'm 46 now, and I think I started in my 30s just, you know, throwing myself through airports and bus terminals and train stations for, you know, pretty long time now. And I suddenly feel very old.
But California is home?
California's been home, yeah, for a pretty long time now, for about 16 years. So all my songs are set here pretty much. All my friends are here. I know where to get my equipment fixed. You know, I've spent as much of my adult life in California as I did in Philadelphia.
Well, I think you have a song about California, which we want to hear because you're to sort of introduce your what you do.
Yeah, this is called I Used to Love California, and I think that's all the introduction I can give it articulately. Well, mornings I'd have one open, watching her as she got dressed for work. Barefoot on the hardwood floor, rushing round in just a Brian skirt. As the morning sun came creeping through the window, bouncing off the closet door. I used to love California, but these days I'm not so sure. We had this little place out in the valley. Things were always safe and warm. So much so I did notice it was getting chilly in her arms. After a while, though, no mistaking, there was less affection in her touch. I used to love California, but lately not so much. I used to love California when California was our happy home. I used to love California till I started in to wake up there alone. Without her, I don't care so much about the desert nights or orange trees. I used to love California, but I've since moved back east. Thank you.
Well, people often ask me, do I hate it there? And the fact is that I don't. I could move back there tomorrow, but in all likelihood I won't. It's a little bit expensive, but you can't beat the quality of life. I used to love California back when we were man and wife. I used to love California, midnight stripping down the 101. I used to love California, kissing in the California sun. It's as good a place as any, really I ain't here to put it down. I used to love California, but that was then and this is now.
Skip Heller playing live in our studio, and he will be playing Saturday night at Shine Cafe at 14th and E Streets in downtown Sacramento. Skip, this is from your new album, which is very stripped down, kind of singer-songwriter roots style, right?
Yeah, I just, you know, what happened was I've been touring with my jazz trio. I'd done some more, I don't want to say expansive stuff, but stuff with a lot of instruments on it. And eventually, you just go like, what the H am I doing? What did I like before I ever got near a record company? What did I like before I ever had a publicist, you know, before people were telling you what you should do? Mm-hmm. And in my case, it was like Gentle on My Mind and Ode to Billy Joe and King of the Road and all the stuff that when I was learning to play really got me animated and that I never got away from. One night I was playing in New York with my trio. And the other act on the bill was a group called Uncle Monk, which is Tommy Ramone from the Ramones mm-hmm. and his wife Claudia, doing like Stanley Brothers and Carter Family type material. As a matter of fact, they opened with Long Journey Home and said to Tommy, why am I not doing this? And he goes, yeah, why aren't you? I said, well, this trio and I've been building it and, you know, I can't just walk away from it because, you know. And he goes, I left the Ramones. Like, okay, you. But it was, you know, he was so nice about it. He was just like, if you don't love what you're doing, do what you loved in the first place. Mm-hmm. What do you like to do? It'll be fine. You're a great musician. You're a nice guy. People want to play with you. Go, you know, he was just really. And the next time I saw him, you know, he was like, dobro player. All right.
Well, it seems like you like a lot of different kinds of music. You'd mentioned earlier that the group that's coming up next, Paloma Negra, you played that style of Mexican
music
as well.
Yeah, I played with Lalo Guerrero for a while. I led a band for him for about 2 years. And for those of you who don't know, he was sort of the father of Chicano music in California. So he was also the guy to bring rhythm and blues into the Chicano music equation in the late 40s. He and a guy called Don Tosti. But also, you know, there were boleros, rancheras, you know, like Son Montuno and all this stuff. So I got a real shakedown cruise education. And, you know, as a result, you know, let's just say that, you know, if I see musicians who have that background, we can find something to play other than just the blues because I know enough of the songs.
And even going further afield, you toured with Ema Sumac?
I did two tours with Ema Sumac.
You might want to fill people in on who she is because that was...
She's this sort of exotic Peruvian singer who came to prominence in the very early 50s. She had an amazing 7.5 octave vocal range. Total diva. but I, you know, very exotic backings, and she could sing something that sounded like it was somewhere between like bird calls, whistling, opera. It's just like one of the great unique voices and a total gift. And trust me on this, she never warmed up. She never did any
really
exercises or anything. She just kind of learned to sing a certain way from imitating birds and stuff in nature and then kept at it. And that was just her thing.
And did you play guitar in that?
I played guitar, yeah. Also, I helped get some of the musicians hired. And so that was interesting because, you know, we had like, I got us the conga player from war.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A guy called Tiki. And it was, you know, he was just such a great showman, too. It was really, Now that she's dead, I can tell some of the stories without fear of reprisal, but because just everything was completely unorganized. But Ema Sumac, you won't see another one of those in your lifetime.
Yeah, it sounds like. You also have done some, you studied with Les Baxter, the Mr. Exotica.
Yeah, he was actually the guy who arranged and conducted and composed the bulk of her first album.
Oh, okay.
Voice of the Extabay, yeah. So I found some of his records. I was fascinated. And my mother's a librarian, so I grew up knowing how to use a library and do research very handily. But there was nothing about him. So I got in touch with him through his publisher. I called him up. Actually, I wrote him a letter. He called me back. And we were talking, and he was trying to... I think he thought I was BSing him a little bit about what music I knew. And he goes, well, you know, for instance, that part in Petrushka by Stravinsky, you know... I was like, I don't want to be contrary, sir, but I think you're singing the Royal March from Les Histoires. And he said, why don't you come out and visit me? So I did, and I would go out for a few weeks at a time and study his music and say, okay, how did you achieve this effect? And he would take the score out, and we would look at it, and that was how I learned about that. And at the same time, he was still very curious, so I was playing him music by Carla Bley and Don Byron and some different people, and he was very open to it. A lot of it he didn't like, but he wanted to know. Mm-hmm. Actually, Carla Bley he liked very, very much.
Interesting. Huh.
So...
Well, let's listen to a little bit of some of your album. In 2009, you did an Exotica album called Lua o Milo.
Yeah, which means Island of Death.
All right, let's listen to a little bit of that. That's Skip Heller on his 2009 album.
Yeah, I guess it was...
And you were playing piano in that?
I was playing... It's not what I would call a bravura piano part. I mean, it's like...
But it definitely has that Les Baxter sort of feel.
Oh, yeah, no, I really... I did things the way he did them. Since Les loved Stravinsky so much, Stravinsky had this one thing called the Symphony in C where he's really quoting a lot of other composers and... Mm-hmm. Poking them very lovingly. So I did the same thing on this CD because, you know, Les would like it. There's a lot of stuff I ripped off from a composer called Charles Ives. But also there's like a song in there called Hurricane Apartment where I took the opening of 2 Minutes to Lunch by Wall of Voodoo. And because I was over at Stan Ridgway's house one night and he was practicing that opening on harmonica and I was there to play on his record, but I was a terrific fan of Wall of Voodoo, of Stan in general.
Another great LA band.
Oh, heavens. And so there I am, and I was like going, oh my word. And I had to write some little piece of music to commemorate the event. So,
well, I think you're the Zelig of rock music. You've been in all these strange little pockets here and there.
Yeah, if I could only turn into a rabbi. No, but that's the way I feel. It's like, honestly, I tended to move around with other people and, you know, quite often do what they're doing. But my first concert was Elvis Presley. My first record I ever bought was Gentle on My Mind. You know, so the music that I gravitate towards the most is still, you know, country music. When I had a paper route, I was out buying Willie Nelson records, you know, in the late 70s.
And that's the music that you're going to be mostly playing tomorrow night?
Yeah, that's
Shine.
Pretty much what I do now. I mean, you know, I get commissions to do, you know, compositions or, you know, different things for other people's brass ensembles or things like that. But I don't really, I mean, I can't get away from the fact that I have certain other music in what I do. But in a way, I almost feel like I'm like this great grandchild of Bob Wills where, yeah, it's jazz, but it's also fiddle tunes. But there's also rhythm and blues in there. There's also Latin music in there. So it's, you know, you can't really disqualify things. Yeah, I can write this kind of weird exotic chamber music, but if I could just write King of the Road, I would be the happiest person in life.
Well, maybe you already have, and tomorrow night somebody might discover it. Skip Heller, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. And if you're listening, wait for the group that's coming up next, because they're just wonderful. I got to hear them in the dressing room, and they're just fantastic.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, and we will have more music in just a minute. Thanks. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. It'll be sunny with highs in the mid-70s in the valley and the foothills today. That's perfect weather for taking a spook-emotive train ride at the California State Railroad Museum. Those are going on all weekend. It'll also be sunny in the Bay Area with highs around 70 there, and that weather is expected to last through the weekend. In Reno, temperatures will be around the mid to upper 60s. Temperatures will be in the lower 60s for South Lake Tahoe. It will not surprise anyone to hear that Monday is Halloween, and with that in mind, we've booked a pair of artists who are giving this Halloween weekend and early next week a bit of a Mexican twist. It's next week is the Dia de los Muertos, and this duo is called Paloma Negra. They're going to be doing three shows here in Sacramento, the city they call home, but play pretty infrequently. They will be playing at Mayahel Museo Tequila at 12th and K tonight. And Monday and Tuesday?
Saturday night.
Okay. Paloma Negra is made up of singer Araceli Collazo and instrumentalist Dominic Garcia. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Okay. And now the two of you are the core of this group, but then you have other players with you?
Yes.
Okay. On a regular basis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We actually have two of those musicians here. Why don't you introduce yourselves?
Okay, hi, I'm Patrick. Nice to meet you. The old joke. Patrick Rizal.
I am Alfonso Galarza. I play the guitar.
Okay. And Patrick is known to local poetry fans and musicians. But you two are local.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm living south of the border now, but I'm from Sacramento.
But you're from Sacramento.
Yes.
Okay. And what prompted this appearance, these appearances this week?
Well, some of my shows that usually go on in Monterrey now were canceled, you know, because of the situation down there, I guess. And so we saw it as an opportunity to come back and just do some shows here, mm-hmm. especially because we have our CD that is inspired in the Day of the Dead, you know, music. Mm-hmm. In our series, we actually have a series that is called Day of the Dead or Día de Muertos, and that's why I ended up here.
Well, you recorded a little while ago, you recorded a track live in the studio for us, and would you introduce it for us?
Yes, that is a beautiful song. It's a farewell song, and it's called Te Vas, Ángel Mío, and it's usually played at cemeteries or funerals. And yeah, I hope people will enjoy.
All right, this is Paloma Negra.
Dejando mi alma herida y un corazón.
That is Paloma Negra live in our studio just a few minutes ago, featuring Dominic Garcia and Araceli Collazo from Monterrey.
Yes.
from Sacramento originally, but now Monterrey. And you're going to be playing these shows. Patrick Gazelle was also on there, a local musician, and you were playing dobro, which is kind of an unusual instrument in Mexican music, isn't it?
It is. And I think Dominic will talk about this a little bit more, but one of the interesting things that happened is that we realized at a point that these two kind of different musical cultures were coming together. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of a great moment. Araceli and I have known each other a long time and have been collaborating on different, you know, aspects of that, you know, combining North and South American music. But I think Dominic could share a little insight on what actually happened with this song.
Because you're the musical director of the group. Yes.
Yes. Well, actually, we were rehearsing in Patrick's living room, and we were going over the song, and Araceli just kind of out of the blue, she was picking on Patrick and told him, hey, why don't you do something? Go get your slide guitar or something. And he did. He brought out the dobro, and it was amazing to be able to just incorporate that into the song and kind of fuse together the Northern Mexican ranchera, you know, this song with like American folk as well, like the dobro, which is, you know, a wonderful folk instrument, American mm-hmm. folk instrument. So like one of the things with Paloma Negra is what we really do, and like almost like kind of like what our mission is to fuse together like different folk music, Latin American and, well, now North American, you know, from the United States. And it was just a wonderful thing. And then after the fact, I kind of realized it, and I was like, whoa, this is a fusion of like North American, you know, United States folk music with Northern Mexican, you know, traditional ranchera. And I just thought it was really cool that it was out of the blue that we
kind of did
that. Yeah.
And the shows that you're doing next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, particularly, are Dia de los Muertos.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They're inspired on this Altar CD. Yes. And the one tomorrow night is basically just, you know, more of a general repertoire.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And is that a big part of the holiday in Mexico?
Very big. Yes. And especially
particular kind of music?
The Dia de Muertos. Mm-hmm. It's just the songs, you know, that touch on the subject of death and honoring, you know, our ancestors and loved ones. And it's interesting what we were doing and what we've been doing in Monterrey for the past 3 years, because it doesn't really happen in the north of Mexico. It's more like something that's celebrated in the central and southern parts of Mexico. So okay. For Monterrey, it was something very new.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but people have plenty of opportunity to go see you tonight and on Tuesday and Wednesday next week, all down at the Tequila Museum at 12th and K, right?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to see you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Jeffrey will be back on Monday. Insight's theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Our assistant producer is James Morrison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. And our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.